You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
A big thank you to the Wonderful Dogs program. It is 1 p.m. here on 3CR Community Radio. And to stay on the theme of public services, we'll now be listening to a public forum entitled War or Public Housing, with four speakers who presented at the City of Melbourne's Multicultural Hub on Thursday, the 16th of April. And we'll be hearing presentations from Louisa Bassini, Mercedes Zanka, Nina Tori Henderson, and David Shoebridge, who will be introduced now by the facilitator.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for coming tonight to this event to help save public housing. Firstly, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land that we're meeting on tonight, the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation, and acknowledge their continuing connection to land, waters and community. This is stolen land. Sovereignty was never ceded. We pay our respects to any First Nations people here tonight and to elders past, present and emerging. There can be no justice without First Nations justice. So again, thanks for coming tonight to this important event. So, the official part of the night. I'd like to ask you all to take an oath to be official defenders of public housing. I'm assuming we're all here because we think it's an important thing to do. So let's make it official and let's swear an oath. So if you'll repeat after me, I solemnly swear, to defend public housing, against political parties, corporations, and everyone, who wants to demolish the buildings, communities, individuals and families who call public housing home. So thank you. You are now officially defenders of public housing. Well done. Woo! There are defenders of public housing stickers up here as well, so feel free to grab one on your way home and proudly display it. So you may be wondering how you got here. I'm sure you all know. Just 2 days before Daniel Andrews stepped aside as the Victorian Premier, he announced that all of the state's 44 public housing houses would be demolished. The announcement was made without consultation with public housing tenants, traditional owners, housing organisations, and apparently even his own cabinet. So instead of the ALP, or the Alternative Liberal Party, laughing this idea off as a thought bubble, a blurt, a spur of the moment fart, they've embraced it and turned it into policy. Someone said to me, the housing system in Australia isn't broken. It's doing exactly what it's designed to do, which is make money. So we've got a housing market that's worth more than the stock market. It's worth more than superannuation. We've got a two-tier property system. Those that can afford to buy, those who can't and are struggling to afford to rent. We see housing as a shelter for money, not people. We see housing as an investment vehicle and not a human right. We see the nation as a welfare state for property owners and developers and investors, and the Victorian government is cutting the biggest welfare check of all, gifting public housing, public land to private concerns. At the same time, cutting costs on the services that are needed alongside public housing to look after the most vulnerable in our society. The ALP is going against its own constitution and its social contract with Victorians. At the same time, we've seen Trump pushing the world to war and demanding more spending on defence from NATO, his so-called allies, and the rest of the world. When the planning for this event started, Trump hadn't even invaded Venezuela or started a war with Iran. Look how quickly the world changes. So tonight's topic, war or public housing. And as someone said to me the other day, it could as well be war on public housing. How can we resist the push to become a weapons economy, like both the ALP and the Coalition want, and instead fund public housing and the essential services alongside them? So tonight, you'll hear from our speakers, a veritable brains trust up here on the front tonight, Louisa Bassini. Louisa is a tenancy and public rights lawyer who's worked primarily with public housing residents over the course of her career. She leads the Social Housing Legal Program at Inner Melbourne Community Legal, together with lawyers from West Heidelberg Community Legal Service, and she's currently instructing in the class action against the demolition of Melbourne's public housing towers, Mallard versus Homes Victoria. Thanks, Louisa. Nina Tori Henderson. Nina is an architect and a researcher based in Naarm, Melbourne. She's currently a PhD candidate at the University of Melbourne and an architect at NMBW Architecture Studio. Nina's a member of the Building Action Now, a coalition of workers from the built environment resisting the demolition of the towers. Thanks, Nina. Mercedes Zanka. Mercedes is an anti-military researcher with Renegade Activists and a community broadcaster on a Friday rave on 3CR Community Radio. Their research focuses on Australia's role in the global military-industrial complex, including weapons, supply chains, critical minerals and surveillance, with particular focus on the geopolitical implications within AUKUS and Australia's defence policy and export frameworks. Thank you. And David Shoebridge. David is a Greens Senator for New South Wales and the Australian Greens spokesperson on justice, digital rights, defence, foreign affairs and migration. David is a recognised voice for social justice and anti-war, campaigning for issues from the legalisation of marijuana to scrapping AUKUS. Thanks, David. So we've got each speaker who can talk for up to 15 minutes. Then there'll be a chance for questions and comments from the audience. We'll have a roving mic go around for your questions, so feel free to use that so make sure everyone can hear you. So, Louisa, would you like to kick off?
Okay, I might keep this brief because I feel like it might be more productive when people ask questions. So I'll just skip through it pretty quickly. So my work experience has been with public housing renters primarily at West Heidelberg Tenants Union and now at Inner Melbourne Community Legal. And, you know, that's been, you know, quite a long time. And I think in that period, it's been really evident that there's this shift happening that is not spoken about openly, that, you know, that Homes Victoria and the government never say we're stepping back from the provision of public housing, but that's clearly what's been happening as far as I've observed. So that's the landscape. I'll talk in a second about the tower demolition program specifically, but I think we have to say that all of it is an approach that's fundamentally characterised by dishonesty. The ground lease model whereby the land isn't actually sold, I think really is as good as privatisation, because I think that in 40 years' time, when that land is no longer being used as really effective public housing supporting communities to grow, because we know that eviction rates are much higher in community housing, for example, I don't think that there will be anyone paying any notice to that land being sold in 40 years' time, because we won't even know of it as something that belongs to us by that point. So one of the statistics, I think, I didn't want to bore you with that, but with too many of them, but this one is, I think, really telling. Since 2006, the number of public housing dwellings has fallen by about 12%. This is despite huge population increases and so forth. So it went from 341,000 to 298,000 in 2024, and that will continue to decline with the tower redevelopment program. In the same period, community housing dwellings increased fourfold, from 30,100 to 119,000. So there's a huge replacement going on. There's no public mandate for this. This is not argued to us as something that's a good thing that's happening. You know, it's just really happened in an underhanded way. And so I think, you know, looking specifically at the tower relocation program, that dishonesty has been reflected in how Homes Victoria has conducted itself with the people who live in those towers, because they have envisaged a situation whereby they would build this community housing as a replacement and just shift everyone in there, and anyone who didn't like it or who has a big family would be moved to the far outer suburbs. And so part of the way that they've affected this is to just tell people that there's no difference between community housing and public housing. And very many people have been told this explicitly. Very many people have not understood the differences. Or they've understood that there's some differences, but they think, oh, well, the rent's not changing, so it's fine. The amount of times we've asked in writing for some legal guarantee that people's rent won't increase and been met with absolute silence, you know, you would not believe. So there's nothing holding these community housing providers, which are non-government private organisations, from actually adhering to these promises that the government is making to justify the tower relocation program. In addition to that, I think it's worth noting that there's a whole raft of other policies that community housing providers don't have that public housing does. You know, and they're too many to mention, and it's too hard to, I think, kind of capture it all. But just to give you a sense of it, disability modifications are really important for people in public housing, especially as they age. You know, aging in place is this thing that's, you know, meant to be preferred. If you don't have an NDIS package, you're not going to be able to get disability modifications done in the home that you move into in community housing, because they have policies whereby they might agree to allow those modifications to happen, but they're not going to pay for them. And that's another aspect of where there's been this kind of dishonesty, because in trying to make the tower relocation program run smoothly, the government has arranged for these modifications to happen for people that they want to move in. But once time goes on, people start to age, and then they might need those grab rails in the shower or whatever. That's when they're going to see that the answer will be no. Like, it's been all smoothed over for now, but at a certain point, their rent is going to go up. They're not going to be able to get disability modifications. They're not going to have a temporary leave of absence right if they need to go back home to their mother country and visit a sick relative or go to drug and alcohol rehab. All of these things are going to start to emerge, and then we'll see that, in fact, public housing and community housing are completely different things. Is community housing cheaper? I would argue that it's not. It's not a cheaper model at all. I met recently with David Haywood, who's an emeritus professor from RMIT, who, you know, is by no means a radical lefty in the way that most of us here would be, but he spoke just so clearly about the way that this is such a flawed policy, just in policy terms, because it is essentially government putting money forward to entice development because they want to be able to build however many thousands of units. Never mind whether these are actually quality homes that people enjoy living in that are, you know, sustainable and affordable and all of that. So they're enticing construction to happen by way of bonds, loans, usually pitched towards superannuation investment. And in order for them to actually invest, these companies want to be able to get a return. They apparently don't get out of bed for less than 15% return on their investments. And where does this money come from? It's obviously pensions. It's Centrelink pensions going straight from the government into the hands of private developers, and somehow pitched as, you know, this kind of like it's less of a burden on the system. It's not. It's financially not a good thing. And it also means that people then don't have any recourse against their landlords when the time comes, in the way that there's some accountability with Homes Victoria. The public housing class action, we wanted to get our hands on a lot of the contracts that have been signed for the redevelopment, and we weren't able to. If you followed it, you'd know that there was a claim made for cabinet privilege, and that was upheld. And so much of it's been, you know, happened in secrecy, which I think, you know, will be interesting to see what comes out in the years ahead when we finally can see those documents. But it's not over yet. We made an application for special leave, which is normally, the outcome of that is normally published the first sitting Thursday of the month that follows. And in fact, it wasn't published last Thursday, which means that they've held it back and they're probably considering it quite deeply, I would say, for them to not have just out of hand rejected it. So we'll find out the next sitting Thursday, which is the 7th of May, we think. And if that proceeds, that will be argued because it needs to be a novel case for the High Court to hear it, primarily on the basis of, one, procedural fairness. We think that people have an interest in their home regardless of whether they own it or not. If these were homes being, taken back to build, a new freeway, there would have to be some consultation with those people. And instead, you know, we have this concept that because people don't formally own these homes, they're not entitled to have that consultation, which I think is just so wrong. And then the second argument is one around community and the fact that community should be protected under the Charter of Human Rights and Responsibilities Act. And it's been completely and utterly ignored. And I think, if there's people here or speaking to anyone who's affected by this relocation, you'd know that, you know, there are so many parents, single parents who don't know how they're going to get by without having that neighbour there to help them collect their kids or being close to their family. And I think it's really devastating, but also inspiring that people are coming together and standing up against it. Thanks.
Hey everyone, thanks for having me. I'm Mercedes, and this podium's a bit daunting. I hope I don't sweat as much as Richard Miles did today at the press club. But in case anyone saw that today Richard Miles announced at the press club that the 2026 National Defence Strategy and Integrated Investment Program. And I think just coming off what Louise was saying about privatisation, that it was an hour and a half to say sweet fuck all really, but a big part of what that was is talking about an increase in private venture capital investing in defence projects. So that's increasing the amount of spending. So what Richard Miles announced today was that through to the next decade, the defence budget is $425 billion. And he kind of boasted about that over the next 4 years, an increase in additional $14 billion over the next 4 years. And I think one of the interesting things, one of the really cooked things that he was saying was that this is, boasting about Labor's defence spending being the largest peacetime defence spending. And it's like, there's a war in Iran right now. And Australia is absolutely complicit. There's been a genocide in Gaza for near on 3 years now, going on 77, But I think that is the privatisation. And so what this means, I guess, with an increase in venture capital firms investing into defence and projects is not only that they get returns, but also that we're going to see even less transparency. There's next to no transparency, but as these things become commercial in confidence and where that funding is actually coming from. So talking about even what the percentage of the GDP, the defence budget is, which at the moment is about 2.8%, Richard Miles's response was that the figures are all there, all you have to do is go through the FOIs that you're never going to get. You have to go through the budget, you can go through the integrated investment program, you can work it out all yourself. So they're actually not providing a figure of what it is of the GDP going forward. And that is on top of the Auditor General now having cancelled the major projects audit only a few weeks ago. So the one that we just got back in December is going to be the last major projects audit. One of the things, and I think, on the privatisation, I think that this is, a decades-long neoliberal policies, which when you're talking about defence and defence industrial base and manufacturing, which is happening in Australia, manufacturing is being bolstered by defence because neoliberal policies remove the capacity for government to fund and give grants for domestic manufacturing, and therefore there's got to be a national security exception for manufacturers. And I think this is really exemplified by the Ford factory in Geelong that closed down is now the flagship Morand facility, which is the flagship of a group called the Australian Sovereign Defence Advanced Manufacturing Group. And they're a conglomerate which are the largest exporter of their 35 parts in Australia of any other company or conglomerate. And so, again, when we see deals like this, they're all commercial in confidence, and I guess coupled with the strengthening of FOI, tightening of FOI restrictions and what is actually being able to be given. And I was just chatting with Nina before, who mentioned that in regards to the high-rise redevelopment program, the feasibility studies and 80% of the documents were withheld from the public around the feasibility of that. And I think that there's reports, but I'm sure Nina will speak more to the housing than I can. But I guess just, one of the things that I think is really important to think about when we talk about defence budget and defence spending is that it's not just strictly limited to defence. Like the Australian government has said itself that it's a whole of government approach. And so when we talk about a whole of government approach, this means education. Like they're just putting $15 million into increasing students coming into STEM programs in schools, specifically for the AUKUS program to work on nuclear-powered submarines that we're never going to get. Who wants them anyway? And when, another thing is the future made in Australia. And so this is this kind of Australian government going, oh, look, we're bolstering manufacturing. It's a $23 billion program, and so $8 billion of that is for renewable hydrogen. It's come out in a report a couple of weeks ago. There are currently 5 renewable hydrogen projects, and for renewable energy, which seems like, you know, obviously, is not a bad thing. But for renewable hydrogen, there are currently about 5 projects that have been shelved because they're unfeasible, because the retooling of companies and facilities to actually be able to use hydrogen is not going to happen because there's no production. And so BHP, all the major multinational corporations, have shelved their projects in renewable hydrogen. But one of the, I guess, what you'd call sovereign companies that is pushing that is Fortescue Metals, Twiggy Forrest. And he's a fuckwit. Like, you know, so the government are kind of just going to, like, fork out more money to Twiggy Forrest. Another part of that, and I guess I just want to speak to this in terms of, like, the whole of government approach of what future made in Australia, because this is $7 billion is being given to the critical minerals production tax credits. And so this is for companies like Lynas, Rare Earths. I'm sure many of you know about the $8.5 billion critical minerals pipeline deal with the US and the Australian government that happened late last year with Trump. Whereas, you know, prior to that announcement of this $8.5 billion pipeline to shore up critical mineral supply chains, the Albanese government really focused on that this was all for renewable energy, but renewable energy wasn't mentioned once in Albanese's announcement about this deal with Trump. It was all for defence, and we know that these, I think, one AUKUS, the nuclear AUKUS Virginia class sub, needs about 12 tonnes of rare earth metals, which outputs about 2,800 tonnes of waste product, not including the actual environmental impact of digging it out of the ground. So the critical minerals production tax credits is $7 billion is just going forked out to private companies who are going to dig up the ground on stolen land for a pipeline to the US defence industrial base, which is now Australia is classed a domestic source in US policy. So we can't, you know. I guess one quickly on one project, because it kind of just seems like defence spending is just moving money around between mates, because I guess when you look at actual, like, material output of money going in, not that, I mean, this is not an argument to say, oh, no, we spent all this money on guns, where are the guns? But the Boxer CRV, which is a combat reconnaissance vehicle, which Rheinmetall got the contract for in 2018, so 8 years ago. Rheinmetall is a German manufacturing company. The munitions for that are by Nioa, which are in Benalla, run by Bob Catter's son-in-law. Universal Motion Simulators, EOS, who I'm sure many of you have seen, Electro-Optical Systems, which have their weapons have been seen in Israel, and Rafael, which is Israel's third largest defence company. So in 2018, there was a $5.7 billion budget to deliver 211 Boxer combat reconnaissance vehicles. I think there was about 14 that have come from Germany. And just a couple of weeks ago, 8 years later, the first Boxer reconnaissance vehicle rolled off to the production line in Queensland that was still had German parts. So after 8 years, as of 2025, so as of the middle of last year, $3.14 billion of that project had already been spent for 20 vehicles. There's supposed to be 211 of them. So the remaining, what, $2.6 billion for another 190-odd vehicles. There's no timeline. They're saying there's no, the commercial in confidence, the deals with Nioa and Rafael and EOS, which are the weapons and munition systems. There's no timeline for when they're actually going to come. So I guess I just want to talk about this to go, like, it's a whole lot of bullshit and just pushing money around between people. It's actually just about keeping the flow of capital going rather than actually having a product under the guise of that we are perpetually at war and we're a target and we need to be strong in the Indo-Pacific and uphold the rules-based order. And I will just say the Boxer CRV in 2021, so initially Albert Systems had the contract for the battle management system, but it was found out that they had a backdoor to Israel, and so they got kicked off the program and then underwent a huge rejig to be able to be operating in Australia again. But those Boxer CRVs are going to be armed with Rafael Spike LR2 missile, which is the same missile that killed Zomi Francom. So when we talk about a whole-of-government approach, and Albanese actually made the announcement apologising to Zomi Francom's family from the floor of Rafael, Vali Rafael in Queensland. So I guess the main thing, is just like when we're talking about a whole-of-government approach, it's like the decision of this government is to build a bigger fence or build a bigger table, and they're building a bigger fence, and they're perpetually building a bigger fence. And when it comes to housing, it's like choosing to house people or choosing to arm the people that are beating them on the street. And that's exactly what they're doing. Every police officer in Victoria who is hassling homeless people on the street, and CSOs now, I'm sure you've seen in the news, there's a petition going around by the Homeless Persons Union at the moment, so you should definitely get on that. But NIOA make guns for VicPol, and they also own Barrett Firearms, which make the snipers that the IDF used to kill Palestinian kids. So when we're talking about the housing towers being demolished, and the communities and the vulnerable communities that are going to be forcibly displaced from their homes and their communities, these are also people who have been forcibly displaced from where they're from because of Australia's military engagement overseas. And so they're being yet again forcibly displaced. And that's older people and vulnerable people. And I think it's really, it feels really weird to talk about defence spending and kind of like put it down to dollars and everything like that, because actually the real cost is like communities being torn apart, it's kids losing limbs, it's people dying, it's people losing their homes. Like that's what the real cost is. It's not just money. And there's no way to gauge what that is except listening to people themselves, but the government don't give a fuck. And they're going to keep doing it, so thank you.
You're on 3CR Community Radio, and we are listening to presentations from a public forum on the 16th of April this year entitled War or Public Housing.
Thanks, Mercedes, and thanks, Darren, for organising and Save Public Housing Collective and inviting me. I'm Nina, as Darren introduced me before, and I'm here tonight kind of speaking on behalf of Building Action Now. And we formed last year to try and build a voice from kind of the broad church of the built environment industry and built environment workers to demand evidence-based and transparent approach to the redevelopment of the towers. So Kat McLeod, who's in the audience today, took the great initiative to initiate the open letter and an open letter and petition to the housing minister, which basically demands, for the government to follow a transparent and evidence-based process with our public assets, which they haven't been doing so far, as Louisa sort of outlined. As built environment workers and professionals, we're required, like, by code and by professional codes of conduct are required to follow these evidence-based processes, and the government's not doing it. So we're basically just asking them to follow due process. So just to talk about the open letter quickly, our demands are very simple. And a lot of this is also aligns with the parliamentary inquiry or the findings from the parliamentary inquiry from last year. So we're basically demanding an immediate moratorium on the demolition of the towers, a release of all documentation that's been withheld by the government, for an independent assessment to be undertaken, and for actual real resident consultation to happen in determining the future designs and plans for the estates. So if any of you work in the built environment industry, please add your name. We have about 700 signatures so far. We're trying to reach 1,000 at the moment. That's our current goal. The website is buildingactionnow.now. And also just want to acknowledge that there's obviously a great number of organisations that have formed in response and in retaliating against the government's demolition of public housing. So there's obviously the Safe Public Housing Collective, 44FU, Rahu, Stop the Demo, And they're all bringing strong voices from residents and sort of housing work and the housing working sector, but we wanted to add to this voice from the built environment industry that also calls for these due process to be followed. So I guess from a built environment perspective, what's kind of alarming us about the demolition of the flats is the lack of transparency. So the government's sort of like going about demolition without really demonstrating that it's sort of like the best and most feasible option. As Mercedes mentioned before, that they withheld over 80% of the documents relating to the redevelopment of the towers and haven't demonstrated sufficient sort of assessments relating to sort of structure, fit for purposeness, etc. There's also sort of alarm bells go off in the sort of announcement of the demolition of all 44 public housing towers at once, this kind of blanket approach to all 44 sites basically points to, they're prioritising the short-term gain they can get out of the sort of economic windfalls from redeveloping these now sort of lucrative inner city sites. So rather what should happen is they should look at, each tower and each site should be looked at on a case-by-case basis, both physically from its kind of like material condition, but also in terms of the community who's living there. Because all of these places require different responses. Also, there's obviously been an alarming lack of resident consultation and communication. Many of the residents found out that their homes were being demolished on the news. And also, it will likely deepen the housing crisis in the short term. So there's been some modelling that's come out of RMIT that has shown that it will take a decade before the what's been demolished will be rebuilt again. So it won't increase housing supply for at least a decade. There's also some sort of like pretty reprehensible policy contradictions in the plan for demolition. So Victoria has a target of net zero emissions by 2045. And meanwhile, they haven't even shown that they've considered renovating the towers instead of demolishing them. So to just kind of put that in context, there's been some recent modelling that's come out of the University of Melbourne recently that maps the Australia-wide housing target. So basically, if we were to continue business as usual construction practices and meet our targets of it's about 200,000 dwellings per year, that would eat up 200% of Australia's emissions budget for everything, just to meet our housing targets with business as usual construction. So, it's basically insanity to not even explore, we can't basically keep doing these knockdown, rebuild, business as usual approaches. It also sets a really dangerous precedent, like what happens now will mean they can act the same way with the rest of the public housing that exists in Victoria, as well as like future public assets, if they don't show sort of like an evidence-based process in the redevelopment. And also, that in the parliamentary inquiry, they found that the government had engaged in processes of managed decline. And if you haven't come across that term, it basically means that they are purposely running these assets into the ground that therefore gives them the reason to demolish them. Yes, and it's also, as Louisa spoke to, the continuation of this ongoing kind of privatisation through the big housing build and the public housing renewal program of public housing. So to just talk about some alternatives to the government's current approach, there's been local studies that have looked into retrofitting the towers. There's been two of them. So Office, who's a not-for-profit design and research practice through their Retain, Repair, Reinvest initiative, did a study of retrofitting Flemington Estate. And that study demonstrated a saving of $364 million and reducing embodied carbon by 54% in comparison to the knockdown rebuild proposal. And then there was a second study done by sort of like a team of researchers and consultants looking at the Atherton Gardens estate, which similarly found cost savings, about a 36% carbon reduction, and up to 20% faster completion rate. And these, both of these studies had inputs from architects, structural engineers, sustainability consultants, and cost consultants. So they were pretty rigorous. And when you put that all together, it saves about $1.5 billion across all 44 public housing towers. There's obviously also benefits for having shorter relocation times. The current, in some of the public housing renewal demolition projects recently, there's been sort of like, it's been 7 years or something like that since residents have been able to return back, and it's a very low return rate. It's like 20% of people that have gone back to the estate. So a retrofit approach, which has been demonstrated in other places overseas, they can be done on floor-by-floor bases. Sometimes residents can stay in place, or if it's coupled with infill development, it means that they can be sort of like, they can stay on the site at the same time while their homes are being refurbished. And I just also say that the government is always arguing that it's inhumane to do construction work while people are on the estates. Meanwhile, they're demolishing the towers while people are still there. Yes. And who the hell doesn't live with construction next door to them if they live in inner Melbourne? Like, it's just happening all the time. One of the other really cooked arguments from the government is that the towers don't meet contemporary building code, and 80% of Melbourne's buildings don't meet the contemporary building code, like pretty much anything that was built in the 20th century. And also, retrofit is sort of like not unusual, and technical hurdles aren't, they're not insurmountable. And all of these, so the main ones that the government sort of repeats is that they have a load-bearing concrete structure, so therefore, you can't move walls. Which is definitely a technical challenge, but it's not insurmountable, that you can't repair the degraded concrete, and there's acoustic, thermal, and fire and disability access upgrades that can't be done. And those reports that I mentioned have dealt with all of these issues, and they have been costed. A big one is structural seismic upgrades for earthquakes. Again, that's done all the time in Melbourne, externally braced. Yeah, and I'd also just say that to sort of back this up with international examples that have actually been completed, there's many examples. Some really well-known ones are in Paris, where they've retrofit very similar concrete social housing towers from the 1960s as well, and they basically expand the building from the outside. So they increase the floor plates. It also greatly increases sort of the thermal performance, energy efficiency, and allows more light in. A lot of these are also done while residents have been in place, because they're built from the outside, and it's sort of like a completely independent structure that sort of adds on. Lots of these projects have won international architecture awards, and it's a model that's repeated across France now. In Vienna, they do the same thing, well, a similar thing with energy retrofit upgrades of their public housing stock, and they have a massive public housing stock compared to here. About 50% of people live in non-market housing. In Toronto, that also has a really large amount of post-war high-rise concrete towers, the government subsidises their retrofit, both public and private ownership. And in the UK, there's lots of examples of estate regeneration that have kept residents in place with a mix of renovation as well as demolition and new infill. There are bad examples as well as good ones there. But one thing I did want to talk about with London, with their estate renewal projects, they have introduced policies where basically if there's any kind of regeneration proposal, either demolishing homes or building new ones on estates, the project needs to be supported by residents through a ballot. So basically any future plan for an estate needs to go through resident consultation, and then after that consultation there's a resident ballot, and if it doesn't get passed with the majority approval, the project doesn't go ahead. Residents here found out the homes were being demolished over the news. This little note I've got here isn't actually in our petition, but I think it's an important thing to mention, and it comes up a lot from sort of a built environment perspective in regards to the towers, is kind of the heritage and cultural value of the towers. So there have been a number of heritage lodgements made for quite a few of the towers. The ones that are coming up to be demolished sort of in the first tranche, the government's put heritage exclusion determinations on them, which basically means they can't get heritage listings in the next 5 years. But at the same time, heritage consultants that have done these have pointed out the sort of kind of like physical cultural importance of these towers. So I think it's important to remember that the flats came into existence through the so-called slum clearances. So they came into existence through a similar government-led kind of widespread demolition program. But at the same time, they're relics from this period when the government was actually building public housing at a large scale. And in Victoria, it's at a scale we haven't seen since then, nor before then. So it's kind of a glitch in the history of housing policy in Australia, which has overwhelmingly been focused just on private home ownership. And they're sort of relics of a time when public housing was really on the agenda and you know, prefabricated, industrialised processes were building them at scale. So they were all fabricated in what's called the Holmes Glen factory, which is in Southeast, which was actually a munitions factory before it was a public, so it's kind of a reverse of what you were talking about. So for me and these other heritage professionals that have tried to put them onto the heritage register, yeah, they're important remnants that mark a time when the government was building public assets, not dismantling them. Yeah, and of course the built history most importantly has housed and continues to house those people that need it most. Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, I'd like to start by acknowledging we're here on Naam on First Nations land and pay our collective respects. This entire continent is an extraordinary place, is all First Nations land. And we're talking about war and housing. And if we're not talking about First Nations rights to housing and the ongoing occupation and the violence, which is so close to a military occupation on this continent of First Nations land, I think we should ground and remember that and bring it back to solidarity and resistance with First Nations peoples on this country too. So let's start by acknowledging that we're here on First Nations land. I'm David Shoebridge, one of the Green senators elected in New South Wales. I do the work for the party in foreign affairs and defence and justice. And it is a real privilege to be here and to be invited and actually to hear the first three speakers and actually hearing Mercedes go through and articulate some of that obscene waste in the defence space and to just give you a sort of lift up the bonnet a bit and have a look underneath about the obscene amount of money that is available for war. I feel really privileged to have heard all three of the contributions. So I'll try and we'll go on a bit of a journey. Maybe we'll start on a bit of a hope, go through a bit of despair, maybe a bit of disbelief, and then maybe try and come back to hope again at the end of the speech. We'll see how that goes. But I'm from New South Wales, proud Sydney sider, and I love coming down here and doing the work in Melbourne and seeing just the depth of the progressive movement down here and the commitment to campaigning on issues like public housing and health and First Nations justice. The work you've done collectively towards treaty, it's extraordinary important work that happens down here in the progressive left political movement. But I also want to tell you some good stories from Sydney. So I'm a member of the Greens, and many of you may not know the origin story for the Greens in New South Wales, but it really begins in a fight for public housing. And one of my political mentors, who I had the privilege of being a member of the Greens with, was a bloke called Jack Mundy, who was the communist leader of a union called the Building Labourers Federation, the BLs. And in the late 60s and early 70s, he took over the union, much to the resistance of Labor and Sussex Street in New South Wales. And when he took over the union, he formed a firm view that peace and social justice was a core part of union politics. And at the time, there was a nasty right-wing Liberal government, which was doing policies not dissimilar to what you've seen here in Labor government in Victoria. And it was a smashing of public housing and the intent to smash and remove public housing from the inner city parts of Sydney, and particularly around the Rocks, which is a historic part and was traditionally a very hardcore working class core in Sydney. And the plan was to demolish the rocks and replace it with a bunch of high-rise private concrete towers. You know, a grand vision from the then Liberal government in New South Wales for an obscene attack on heritage, an obscene attack on history. But what for Jack, it was an attack on communities and an attack on social housing and public housing and the rights that people had to maintain their communities and live in their homes. And so he began a movement of having the union black ban any demolition or any work to destroy public housing. And got himself arrested, had the union attacked, then began to expand that movement of black banning public housing, demolition of public housing, to black banning the demolition of urban bushland and black banning the proposal to destroy parts of the Botanic Gardens and Centennial Park for development. And it eventually morphed into this movement called the Green Bans. And the Green Bans was this absolute, you know, unity ticket between the environment movement, the social justice movement and organised labour to protect these beautiful parts of the city and to protect these communities and to protect public housing. And as that developed, it got the attention globally, and a woman came over from Germany and came and saw all this activity happening in Sydney. Her name was Petra Kelly. And then she then trotted back to Germany and began the first ever Greens Party in Germany, taking the inspiration from the Greens Band movement that she'd seen with Jack Mundy in Sydney. And then it travelled back and became the Greens New South Wales, which has a strong core in social justice and environmental justice. So I want to tell you this coming together can work. And it saved an incredible amount of public housing in Sydney, saved communities, saved precious parts of our city, inspired a generation or two, including myself, of activists and politicians. But then I did say I'd do a bit of despair. And 45 years after that, that extraordinary achievement of protecting those houses and those homes and those communities, a new Liberal government came in with the active support of the Labor Party in New South Wales and literally sold them out from underneath them. Tore out those communities, tore out those homes, ripped men and women and families who had been living in there their whole of their lives and has destroyed that part, that history and those communities. And I worked and campaigned alongside many of them, and I know many of them as particularly the older parts of those communities, as their houses were sold from under them, as their communities were destroyed, as their history was ripped apart, they were relocated to die. And in a sense of despair at what was happening to their communities. This stuff matters. Fighting for communities matters. Fighting for public housing and the right for people to have that connection with where they live and their history. This stuff absolutely matters. I might take that public housing oath and I might take it to our federal party room and get us to recite it once a week. It's an extraordinary achievement. 'Cause this matters, right? And then following that, we've seen in New South Wales the program that's been spun here, the destruction of public housing, its partial replacement with a tiny smattering of community housing, and the conscious destruction of communities and pockets of resistance. And it is wicked. It is wicked. And everything Louisa said about your rights in public housing compared to your rights in community housing, the eviction rates are so much higher in community housing than public housing. You don't have that security of tenure. You don't have that guarantee that you'll have your home for life and the adjustments you need to live in it to age in grace in your home. That is all ripped from you, let alone any right to a fair rent that is going to be held in place by the political pressure of it being in public hands and public housing. This stuff absolutely matters. So you keep being told, we keep being told, there's no money for public housing. We have to do this. We have to destroy these houses and then engage in some complex financial arrangement with a bunch of super firms and private equity firms to find the capital to build public housing, because no government's got any money to do this kind of stuff, right? The same party, the Labor Party, who's saying that in Victoria and New South Wales and saying it federally, today that same Labor Party just announced a new updated national defence strategy and trumpeted that they were going to spend an additional $53 billion over the next decade on defence, an additional $53 billion. Money that has been stolen from public services, money that's been stolen from public housing, money that's been stolen from us, and as Mercedes made very clear, is largely going into the pockets of private corporations who sit there like rent seekers, stealing public wealth and redirecting it into the profits and shareholding value of some of the most obscenely wealthy people on the planet. That's what's happening. And behind that, to justify this collective theft from us, we get these political campaigns to manufacture fear in our community. And if any of you had the misfortune, and I know Mercedes did, but if anyone else had the misfortune of watching the Defence Minister, Richard Marles, give his contribution today, he's a man of minimal achievements. He's a man of minimal vision. And I think he's sizing up his post-career, his post-politics career as a representative of the global arms industry. So I suppose he has some vision, that personal vision in life. But he said, and I'll try and repeat some of it. I'll try not to do it in the same disturbingly deadpan manner of Richard Marles. But he said, look, the world's got very dangerous. There are parts of this, there are actors in the world who are ignoring basic concepts of national sovereignty and threatening to invade other countries. There are countries that are ignoring international law and in breach of international law and norms that we've all understood, the rules-based international order that we've all been committed to that keeps countries like Australia safe, is being ravaged and attacked. And therefore, we need to go to war with China. He literally said that. He didn't say go to war with China. No, I take the objection from at the back there. That this is true. He said we need to work and ensure that we enmesh the United States into our region so that we have a partner to resist Chinese expansion and these terrible actions that China is doing, you know, threatening sovereignty, breaking international law, tearing down the rules-based order. And at no point in this bloke's speech, maybe he doesn't own a TV. Maybe he's not allowed to get data on his phone, I don't know. Because how could you possibly be looking at the world at the moment and seeing the obscenity of the last 12 months of Donald Trump, the United States and Israel threatening to invade Greenland, destroying international law, tearing down the rules-based order, engaging in illegal wars, throwing the entire world's economy into chaos, throwing our lives and our economic lives into chaos and saying, I know my conclusion from the last 12 months. We better double down on AUKUS, buy some more US weapons and try to go to war with China. It is insane. It is insane, except for it's happening, right? Except for it's happening. And they are planning to redirect $375 billion of our collective wealth into building nuclear submarines to make part of this vision a reality. They're going to war. Because nuclear submarines are not designed to defend Australia. If you want to defend Australia, you do things that work around Australia, right? And the intent of a nuclear submarine is the secret sauce for them of a nuclear submarine is that it can travel thousands of kilometres away and, to use a Richard Marles quote, which I hate, engage in impactful projection, right? Impactful projection. It sounds like an adult movie, but impactful projection is his phrase that he keeps using. And what by impactful projection, what he means he wants the Australian military to be able to engage in the application of force anywhere on the planet. Because he says Australia is a global trading nation. We rely on sea routes we trade with the world. And if we're going to protect our sea routes around the world, we need to be able to project military force anywhere on the planet. Anywhere on the planet where our trade is being threatened. That is the most nuts vision for our defence force. We're a country of, what, 27, 28 million. We have a real but modest manufacturing base. The idea that we can be globally projecting force around the world to protect the sea lanes. I mean, Poor old bloody Singapore. What's Singapore going to have to engage in with its global trade? Like, it's an insane proposal that that is what they're intending for our military. But the reason they go through that fiction and they create that fiction and they say this is what we need, we need to be able to have impactful projection and we need to project force anywhere in the world to protect our sea lanes, it's so that they can then take the next step in their argument. And they say, therefore, we need to be allied with the United States and be part of the United States military, have our military interoperable with the United States military to be able to just slot into US global wars wherever they're happening so that we can be part of an alliance which engages in impactful projection anywhere on the planet. And the only way you can square that circle in his brain to engage in global war is by literally inviting and surrendering to and making ourselves a hostage to the United States military. And that's how they square the circle. To engage in impactful projection, to protect our global sea trade, we must be a tiny cog in the US global military war machine. And therefore, we need to spend $375 billion on building nuclear submarines so that we can be a little bit of a contribution to their containment strategy to go to war against China. And that's why we're spending $8 billion building the United States a nuclear submarine base off Perth. We're doing it now. We're going to have it up and running by 2027. We won't have any nuclear submarines on anyone's strategy by 2027, but we're going to have a nuclear submarine base built by Australian taxpayers up and ready to go just off Perth by 2027. And we could have this discussion about land fighting vehicles, we could have this discussion about Hunter frigates, about Triton drones, about ghost bats and ghost sharks and all this obscene expenditure on US military equipment and this massive transfer of wealth. And we don't have money for public housing. So how do we fight this? How do we find the money for public housing? How do we stop and resist this? Well, the good news is we've got allies in this space. When it comes to the conversation with the Australian public, one of our great allies is Donald Trump, right? You only have to see the guy, you only have to follow his movements, you have to do what Richard Miles doesn't and turn your TV on or watch your social media feed. No one wants to be a part of that. They see him and the United States not as some defender of the rules-based order who we should be inviting into our backyard, but as a bloody menace who we should be stepping away from. And if we want to find ourselves $375 billion to spend on public housing, I've got a good strategy. Let's campaign collectively to end bloody AUKUS, to shut down US bases here, to redirect that funding to the things that matter in our lives. And this is, I wanted to end on hope. This is more achievable than ever before, to distance ourselves from the United States. They are making the argument for us. They are making the argument for us. This insane chaos, this obscene war against the people of Iran, against the people of Lebanon, against the people of Gaza. And I'll tell you this, I have so much more in common. We all have so much more in common with the mum and dad taking their kids to school in Tehran at the moment and wondering if they'll be safe and they'll come home. Or the family in Shiraz going to work and wondering if their city will be bombed and they'll be safe on their return. Or the student in Beirut wondering if their flat will be targeted by an Israeli airstrike. Or the 70-year-old woman in Minnesota who's blowing a whistle at ICE and calling and to protecting their neighbours. That's who we have in common with. And that's the global solidarity we need to connect to. We have so much more in common with those people around the world than with the likes of Donald Trump or Benjamin Netanyahu or bloody Anthony Albanese or whoever the goon is running the Victorian Labor Party down here in New South Wales. We have so much more in common with those people around the world, and we can build this movement and we can terminate AUKUS and we can separate ourselves from the United States and we can redirect these funds to what matters, and that's why we're here. Thanks very much.
Cool. Thank you very much to our speakers. That was fantastic. Appreciate it. Thanks for the support. It's a big fight, as you've heard. What keeps me going is this. There ain't no power like the power of the people, and the power of the people don't stop. So we're the people, the power's in this room, and we're not going to stop until they stop the demo. So thank you very much for coming.
And we've been listening to presentations from Louisa Bassini, Mercedes Zanka, Nina Tori Henderson and David Shoebridge from a public forum Thursday, April 16th, called War or Public Housing. To listen back, head to 3cr.org.au/actingup, where we'll be publishing the audio in full. Stay tuned to 3CR. Up next, Swing and Sway.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast. If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.